Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine of the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor.
This week, we ask, what do the four Conservative candidates stand for? What's the future for trail hunting? And is Sally Rooney mania over? Head of Tory party conference, Katie Balls, our political editor, interviewed each of the leadership candidates for Spectator TV.
Why do you think the Tories lost the 2024 election?
We lost the ear of the British public. They stopped listening to us.
The government didn't address properly, in a truly conservative way, the big issues.
But the bottom line was people didn't really understand what we stood for.
There's many reasons, but the fundamental one is we lost the trust of the British people.
You can watch the full hustings on The Spectator's YouTube channel, Spectator TV, and find a short transcript in the magazine opposite Katie Balls' cover piece, where she writes, Fight Club, who comes out on top? Katie says that next week is the most important week of this very long-running Tory leadership campaign, where the final two candidates are set to be decided. And she looks ahead at the dark arts and guerrilla tactics that we're likely to see at the Birmingham conference. To discuss further, Katie joined us on the podcast alongside Ruth Porter, the Conservative peer.
And I started by asking Katie to briefly take us through each of the four candidates' pitches and what they stand for.
Yes, as you say, Will, I think probably if we're trying to work out the most important week, it's the week coming up, because then straight after they've all, you know, performed in beauty, depending how you define it, beauty parade for some at the conference, they then get back to London and head to Parliament the following week. And there's two knockout rounds, and that's when they go from 4 to 2 and it goes to the membership. So this is a chance to really set out their pitch, convince MPs and also members that, you know, they should be the ones to go there, and then have the membership support if they do make it. In terms of the pitches from each of the candidates, I think that Robert Jenrick, who's currently the bookies' favourite, former Home Office Minister who quit over the Rwanda scheme not going far enough, he is really probably basing his campaign around migration, limiting legal migration and taking strong action to limit illegal migration in the future through the withdrawal of the ECHR. And he is the only candidate who is saying very cleanly, we have to leave the ECHR. Some are fudging a bit more around that. So I think he is seen to the right on those areas. He's also talking about other things, but I think that has been the underlying pitch. And therefore, he would define it as moving to the centre of public opinion. It just might not be the public opinion that lots of people call the centre, but doing it in a smooth, polished manner. Then you have Kemi Badenoch. I think she is pitching herself as an authentic, freedom-fighting, you know, hard-truth leader. And she is choosing not to get into policy specifics in this leadership election. I think, if anything, you get the sense from her camp that they're frustrated that other candidates wanted to get into the, you know, specifics of policy. Instead, she's saying, we have to go back to first principles and we have to think about how can we be conservative again. And she says the problem that they had at the last election was ultimately not being conservative enough and talking as though you're on the right, but actually doing things as though you're on the left. So I think both Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch are seen as probably the candidates most to the right of where the Conservative Party is. Then you have James Cleverly and Tom Tugendhat. Now, their pitches are obviously different in places, but I think they are fairly similar in the sense that both are saying one of our problems was we weren't unified enough, we need to unify, whereas Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick will say, yes, we should unify, but not at the cost of, you know, not doing certain things. James Cleverly is saying that he is the most experienced of the candidates in the race. He served as foreign secretary. He served as home secretary. He's a known team player. taking that Home Secretary job, and it looked a bit like a hospital pass, and other members of the cabinet had made it quite clear they would not take it. And he's saying he's ready to step in because Keir Starmer is doing so badly at the moment that you need someone who can just hit the ground running and be ready for what could be returning to power in a couple of years' time. Tom Tugendhat is saying that he is ready to be prime minister and he can restore trust because he has lots of integrity. And he's probably a bit more hawkish on foreign policy or talking about more than some of the other candidates.
Ruth, you ran Liz Truss's successful leadership campaign in 2022. How did you approach it? What was your strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so from a very tactical point of view, there's two phases really to the campaign and there's some crossover between them, but there's also big differences. So in the MP phase at the beginning, to get down to that final two, you've got this challenge that people aren't sure who is going to make that final two and they're trying to hang back. Most MPs want to ultimately support the person that is going to end up winning. And so actually getting MP volunteers to help corral their fellow MPs, getting them to endorse, and we've seen that already quite a lot, the use of that is really, really important. There's also a lot of discussion around tactically how, you know, trying to game who gets through to the final two. So you hear camps saying, well, if you support our candidate, it will stop this other candidate making it through to the final two. So there's a lot of kind of scheming, which doesn't go on when you get to the final two. And I think you also then have, against this backdrop, the sense of actually establishing really soon, really early on, is my candidate someone that I can convince both MPs and members can be a winner here? Mm. So polling is hugely, hugely important in terms of being able to go out to the country, getting your polling data and actually demonstrating and saying, look, this is someone who at the next election would win back enough support for the Conservatives that actually they will be the person. And MPs, they want to support the person often who will be the person who ultimately ends up winning the leadership. But also, more importantly, they want to support someone who they think genuinely is going to be a successful leader for the party. Mm. So in the first stage, those are kind of some of the things that you're focused on. In terms of the team and how you run the campaign, it's really important to be very focused, very tight. So you're keeping confidential, accurate information on the counts of which MPs are supporting who. It's really, really important. So you generally have a relatively small team for that first phase. Mm. You then, in the second phase, have to very quickly scale up. So I think we went, for example, from about 20 people on the initial core team very quickly to, I think, around like over 70 for the second phase. And with the members, it becomes something that is a very different kind of campaign in that final two. So effectively, a lot of it comes down to logistics. So the aim of that second phase, or what's crucial to that second phase, is to get directly in front of as many of those voters. Last time it was 140,000, roughly, people who voted. Everyone's saying it's going to be less than that this time, but we'll see what the current membership is, that you want to try and get in front of them, and that membership's dotted around the country. So you actually have to be quite clever in terms of working out which associations do we go to, how do we organise events where we get associations to cluster together, what's the sequencing, and you have to work out that schedule all coming in under the spending cap, which is actually quite a kind of, it's no mean feat. And so you've got that. And then you also try and get media endorsements for the publications and the outlets that the members read. So things like The Mail, The Telegraph, GB News, The Spectator.
That's the only one you need to read. Yeah. Katie, Ruth was talking just then about, you know, the different phases of having to woo MPs and then having to woo the membership. But there's something you touched on your piece, which you seem to say that there's a bigger divide between what the MPs want and what the membership wants than there has been for certainly many years. I wondered if you could explain that a little bit for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I think this is a risk depending on how conference goes. And I think you look back, you know, there's not many times in history that you've had the party conference take place when the leadership question is an open one. It was pointed out to me, I said, you know, this is only the third conference where they're trying to, you know, decide who will be the next leader. And someone said, the Tories are trying to decide who will be the next leader every day. they might not be doing it officially. There's obviously all that going on behind the scenes, but where there is a very clear actual vacancy. But you think back to 2005 when it was the most recent time, and David Davis was seen as a favourite. Then David Cameron very famously gave a very powerful speech. So things could move around. But I think the risk is the Tory membership, Tory grassroots, ultimately feels quite separate from the centre these days. You look at what has happened. Ultimately, members voted for Boris Johnson. MPs decided to get rid of Boris Johnson. That was not a decision by the membership. Then you had Liz Truss become leader. That was the membership's choice. But then, obviously, you know, a lot happened during that period, the mini budget. But the decision, again, was not taken by the membership to get rid of her. It was taken by MPs. And then the membership were not given a say on her successor because MPs thought the situation was too volatile. But, of course, they then had a leader who, Rishi Sunak, who they had never wanted and actually had rejected through votes. And then I think you look at what happened during the general election, the candidate selection, which happens in most general elections, to be honest. The centre, number 10, tried to get their favourite candidates, boys and so forth, into those seats. And lots of associations felt they had thrust on them, candidates that were not right for them, and candidates not reflect where they were. And therefore, I think that you have a grassroots and a membership that is a bit suspicious of the centre and the antics of MPs, particularly because the party hasn't been doing well. And they think it's drifted in terms of managerialism and so forth from lots of the things they care about, the reason they joined. And therefore, this could be a good opportunity to bring the two back together. But I think the risk is, you know, at the moment, the membership polls suggest that Kemi Badenoch is quite far ahead as a membership favourite. So I think there is a risk if you don't have Kemi Badenoch on the ballot and at conference no one else emerges as a grassroots favourite, that people will feel they've been deprived of a choice again. And I think that's the risk in this contest, which is, you know, do you end up in a situation where the membership and the MPs, you know, all 121 of them, seem further apart? Because I think that is a difficult place for the party as it attempts to rebuild.
So is there behind-the-scenes scheming to try and stop Kemi Badenoch from reaching the final two?
I mean, there's always behind the scenes scheming, isn't there? I think there's, you know, if you are in Robert Jenrick's team, this is just my view, you would obviously, I think, prefer to be going up against James Cleverly or Tom Tugendhat with the membership, because the polling suggests that Robert Jenrick is a little bit ahead. And so he would perhaps have an advantage against those two, but also it's competitive. I think going up against Kemi Badenoch as things stand, she could be beaten, but it's a harder thing to do. So probably the easiest place to knock Kemi Badenoch out is not the... There are two rounds of voting in, you know, succession of a day each. That first round is probably going to be Tom Tugendhat or James Cleverly going, because they are fishing in the same pool of MPs. Then whoever goes out, it will then be for James Cleverly or Tom Tugendhat to try and sweep up all of the others' supporters. And if they manage to do that, and perhaps a few Robert Jenrick supporters wake up that morning and go, you know what, James Cleverly seems like a really nice guy who I can back for one day, you could have a situation where Kemi Badenoch is edged out by about two votes and doesn't get to the membership. And that's the scenario her team at least are worried about. So they'll be trying to use this conference. And one of the details I have in the piece is, you know, I think there's going to be some quite hilarious stalls at this conference. They had to pick blank envelopes to decide whose stall was where in the conference hall, because obviously just a few metres difference could decide how many activists you get. But lots of stash. But I think there's going to be selfies, you know, things saying, I back whoever it is. The phrasing of the Kemi Badenoch one is going to be, I want to vote for Kemi Badenoch, effectively, which is to try to say, you know, to MPs, I want to be given the opportunity to vote for her. So they're going to be trying to push that message.
Ruth, Katie mentioned there some of the shenanigans that we're going to see. Was there anything kind of particularly absurd or strange that you had to deal with during your leadership campaign?
That's an interesting one. I think what was quite different about that leadership campaign was that there was very clearly a battleground. So the entire thing was very framed. So it was tax rises versus tax cuts, framed in terms of growth, delivery. And I think that's very different to this time, where it's not really clear at the moment what exactly the exam question that the different leadership candidates are setting out their stall for is. So Katie went through some examples there of a few positions that people have taken, but actually so far they haven't said very much. Probably weirdly, one of the areas, or not weirdly, I mean, I think importantly, one of the areas which all four of them have talked about quite a lot, which I think is really positive, is this disconnect that Katie mentioned between the membership and the MPs. I think actually that's been recognised very strongly by all four candidates, and they've all said and set out various things they would do to try and address that if they became the leader. But I think going into to conference and hearing what they all say from that main stage, the key thing is actually, okay, what is your vision beyond the Conservative Party? But actually, what's your vision for the country? And that at the moment feels like it's quite absent from this discussion, which I think is quite different to in the past.
Well, Katie and Ruth, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. Thank you.
Will, what did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I really enjoyed Rachel Johnson's diary. She's done our diary column for this week. She writes about going to Liverpool for the Labour Party conference, which is only marginally less glamorous than being waterboarded in freezing lakes for celebrity SAS, Who Dares Wins, which she also has appeared in recently, and writes about that. And we can hear an excerpt from her diary now.
My principle of doing reality TV shows is that you should never watch them before you attach your name. If you did, you'd never sign up. And never watch them afterwards either. It's too awful. Plus, the spectator party is Paul Roger at the Pullman. The correctness of my decision is confirmed by those watching Celebrity SAS So I Don't Have To. All you're allowed to take into camp is pants and bra. There is no hair and makeup. We are being trained for winter warfare in the New Zealand Alps, and it's so cold the water has frozen so nobody washes, apart from the daily waterboarding in freezing lakes. I might add that glamour is also in very short supply in Liverpool, even though Rachel Reeves's Barnet is super glossy, and Emily Maitlis is in strappy gold stilettos at the spectator party. I check my phone as I walk back to my hotel. Episode 1 ends with all the recruits having to storm a house where a hostage is being held as bombs go off, save him and shoot his captors. Totally hooked and desperate for you to make it, texts the former health secretary and last season Celebrity SAS veteran Matt Hancock. The critic Camilla Long warns me as a friend that I look like the wreck of the Deutschland throughout. My father is even more loyal. I loved it when you shot the hostage, he writes.
Tony Blair famously described the decision to ban fox hunting as one of the biggest regrets of his premiership. Is it one that Keir Starmer is likely to repeat? 20 years on from the hunting ban, it looks as though trail hunting may also be banned. Flora Watkins writes in the magazine that it might be too late to save the thrilling, sociable, bloodless sport. Flora joined us on the podcast alongside the wildlife campaigner Dominic Dyer for a rather heated debate. Flora, in the magazine this week, you ask whether it's too late to save trail hunting. Can you just tell us first, what is trail hunting?
Well, trail hunting, this slightly complicates Labour's manifesto pledge to ban trail hunting, because while researching this piece and talking to people in Hunt Service and Masters and people involved with putting trail hunting's case forward, one of the reasons they think there's a delay, there may be a delay, is because Labour aren't really sure what they're banning. So you've got trail hunting, you have bloodhounding, and you have drag hunting. So bloodhounding, drag hunting have never followed a live quarry. Trail hunting is what has replaced, so former foxhound packs, former harrier packs who hunted hare pre-ban, trail hunting is what they do, or are supposed to do now, where they follow animal scent, usually urine. My little boys have gone on the quad bike dragging the smelly sock with our local trail hunt. And it more mimics the sort of rhythm and tempo of hunting a live quarry. So it's more stop-start, you know, because a live animal can lose the hounds pursuing it. It can, you know, go to a field of sheep. It's sort of slower and not quite as fast and furious as bloodhounding and drag hunting, which I've never really done much of. But as I understand it, it's to give the mounted field sort of an adrenaline-fueled ride over lots of hedges and big fences at speed. Whereas trail hunting mimics pre-burn hunting of a live quarry, which is slower and gentle, perhaps. It's not fast and furious.
Mm. And Dominic, what's your view? Even though trail hunting is a bloodless sport, or supposed to be a bloodless sport, should it be banned?
Well, I think the problem really comes back, and I was talking about this at the Labour Party conference the last few days, to the Hunting Act of 2004 when it was introduced. You know, it was introduced at a time when, you know, the Labour leader, Tony Blair, Prime Minister, was not particularly keen on the idea of restricting hunting in the countryside. And it was a compromise piece of legislation, and it wasn't implemented effectively to a large degree, and it's got more holes than a Swiss cheese. And what the hunting fraternity have done is really sort of run a cart and horses right through the middle of all those loopholes to come up with trail hunting, which is really just a means by which you can try and continue as much as possible a hunting process that was meant to be made illegal through the legislation. And the problem is you are following an animal-based trail. The problem is you're using a pack of foxhounds, and foxhounds will naturally chase down wild animals, you know, and kill them. That's what they are there to do effectively as pack animals. And you are, you know, going through areas of the country where, you know, obviously it's clear that there are foxes present. And this is a problem. And also, I think the bigger problem about trail hunting to a degree from a broader public perspective is controlling packs of hounds. You can't control them effectively. So they end up on roads. They end up on railway lines. And I've been on a busy road where, you know, a pack of foxhounds have come across, and it's quite frankly terrifying and very, very dangerous. And they go into people's homes and gardens. And at times they've been killing domestic dogs and cats, as you know, and that's become a big issue. And around it, of course, you've got the activities of the terrier men who are out on the quad bikes with their terriers, filling in badger sets, which is illegal on the Protection of Badgers Act, because they don't want the hounds to go to ground into the badger sets. You know, you've got illegal activity, and you've got dangers to the public, and you've got a lack of control, which is why I think increasingly the police have said, listen, you know, we want legislation we can enforce effectively, which is what, you know, Chief Inspector Mac Longman from Devon and Cornwall Police has said on a number of occasions in recent months. And then you've got hunts themselves who are just making it worse because, you know, they're taking fox cubs and throwing them to hounds. We've seen some horrible illegal activity that's been across the media. And I know the hunts are trying to regulate themselves better and saying we're going to clean our act up, but the damage to a large degree has been done. And the final point I would come back on from what you were saying at the beginning, that, you know, there was an alternative. There is an alternative, and that is drag hunting. And you know,
but it's not. I totally agree with you that some hunts have behaved appallingly, but I have seen trail hunting done properly. Our local, well, they were a harrier pack, so they hunted hare pre-ban. We go out with them, and the hounds hunt beautifully. They have got them running beautifully. And I talked to a lot of hunting people, a lot of whom have despair of how things are going, to write this piece. And as I understand it from them, hounds are less likely to riot, that is, go off after something than not go off after live quarry if they're hunting an animal scent. And I also, you know, there was from the National Trail Hunting Day a few weeks ago, there's a post here, which is in my piece, the Lincolnshire Police Rural Crime Action Team, which reads, "Today was an excellent example of how it can and should be done. Interestingly, we saw plenty of hares in the fields today, with numerous hares being put up by the hounds following pre-laid trails. No hounds showed interest in them. It can be done properly. And not everyone wants to go drag hunting or bloodhounding, because I say it's fast and furious. You need a very big, very good horse, whereas old-fashioned hunting, which is when it's done properly, is replicated by trail hunting. If you've got a sound horse that's fit, you can go hunting, and it's wonderful and sociable, and it means my children are off screens and they're out in the countryside watching clever hounds work and having an appreciation of how the countryside, sort of the topography and being outside. And it's just wonderful.
Flora, what I would say is this about the hounds. You've got to look at having packs of hounds and the issues around the animal welfare of those hounds.
You know, they're not kept well in many cases. They don't get much veterinary intervention when they get injured. They are killed with bolt guns in many cases. And we've seen lots of footage of those dogs being killed in that way, which horrifies people. And those animals often end up in dangerous places because, you know, that you cannot control large packs of animals.
I mean, we're getting away from it now, but is putting an animal down with a bolt gun any worse than filling them full of amphetamines? I mean, that is quite a bunny huggery way of looking at dispatching an animal. And I've never seen hounds treated. I mean, I've been hunting most of my adult life, both pre and post-ban. I've been to many hunt kennels. They're looked after beautifully. I don't think that's a valid argument at all to say that hunting people don't care about their hounds.
I don't agree with that. I think the idea that you can keep a pack of hounds, feed them, some cases we've seen TB-infected meat being fed to those hounds from raw carcasses, you're not getting the levels of veterinary intervention you need to in many cases. Those hounds cannot be easily rehomed. They don't make good domestic pets because of the nature of
three basset hounds in my kitchen.
And I think it's holding on to that. That's a problem.
From a hunt. They're amazing pets.
Well, you might have been fortunate, but there are lots of bad practices going on. I'm not saying here that you should be restricting people's access to the countries.
I don't agree that hunts do not look after their hounds properly.
Well, I think there's been lots of evidence where that has been the case. There might be good hunt packs, I agree with you. I've no doubt there are, but there are many that are not doing that. And I think that's the problem with the whole hunting system. Who? You're seeing too many cases of bad animal welfare with regards to the actual pack of hounds. And you've not answered the question, as I've said, about there are very strict laws on you as an individual and me on an individual about how we should look after our animals and our dogs and how we should keep them under control. The fact of the matter is you've got a large number of foxhounds following a scent, running across a railway line, running across the main road, and this happens regularly, and it's damn dangerous, and it's very scary for everyone.
Quite often, Dominic, they are got off that line by aunties blowing hunting horns and using artificial scent to get them off it.
They do.
I mean, yes, occasionally horrendous accidents happen, but, you know, the quote in my piece, police actually seeing Lincolnshire, which is one of the most heavily haired counties in the whole of the UK. It's where most of the convictions under the Hunting Act have come for illegal hare coursing, not by hunts affiliated to the British Hound Sports Association. They can do it when it's done properly. The issue that I thought we were here to discuss is that hunts, unfortunately, not all of them have behaved unimpeachably. And that's a great shame. And I think has got us to this situation where it's now a manifesto commitment to ban it. But again, as I started off by saying, I don't think Labour actually know what they're banning.
Well, you've not also answered the question of the terrier men. Why do you have terrier men on hunts? Why do you have quad bikes with terriers in boxes following these packs of hounds? What purpose do they have other than illegal wildlife criminal activity?
Well, is it illegal to dig a fox out of a hole?
Fill in a badger set, yes, and they do it regularly. The Protection of Badgers Act, very clear on that, and we've got huge amounts of footage of terrier men regularly filling in badger sets. That should not happen, it does happen.
No.
And that's illegal wildlife crime.
The point of the terrier men is if a fox goes to ground, is to dig it out so it can be shot, which, as I understand it, is...
The problem you have is that you don't have control and regulation of this area activity. I think that is the issue here. But I am, because it happens, and that can't be avoided if you're talking about controlling what goes on in the countryside in this situation.
Well, no, but if a hunter is trail hunting properly, they have no cause to fill in badger sets.
But they are. They're not being regulated. So that comes back to the law, doesn't it?
Well, they should be being regulated by the police because, as you say, it's wildlife crime, not part of legal trail hunting.
Dominic, is the problem here not that the police are failing to carry out the law as it already stands? You're saying that what we need is to beef up the law because the police currently aren't following it. They aren't going out and catching people, as Flora says, who occasionally break the law. It seems to me a kind of strange situation to argue for more legislation purely because the current legislation isn't being enacted.
I think the police will tell you that it's far worse than that, with due respect. They're saying that we've got a confrontation in the countryside between, quite frankly, militant hunt activists and militant anti-hunt activists, and they don't want that. That takes away valuable police time having to deal with it, and I don't think anyone wants to see that type of confrontation in the police having to deal with in the countryside. You've got this public order problem, but also you've got the public safety problem, the packs of hounds getting into places where they're not under control and causing real danger.
Dominic, you don't have packs of hounds going around the country marauding and, you know, ripping up people's cats. They're very odd, isolated.
Sorry, but you've got that all the time. But we've got lots of evidence of that. You're almost saying that this doesn't happen, you know.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but the way you talk about it is if there are, you know, packs of slathering hounds going around the countryside.
I could find you lots of examples of people that are absolutely horrified by what they've experienced with packs of hounds coming into their land, farmers on their lands. People are just coming into their homes, you know, killing their cats on their doorstep. This happens. It can't be something that you just say, dismiss it as if it never happens. The police have to deal with the consequences.
I'm not dismissing it. It certainly has happened. But the way you make it out is every time a pack of hounds...
I'm not certain you can control them very well, Flora. That's the problem. You might say that there are some very well-controlled packs. I'm not convinced of that.
But I've given you evidence from the police that says when it's done properly, you can't...
In Scotland, the legislation has restricted the number of animals down to a very tight, small number. Part of the reason for that was to try and deal with the danger of them going onto public highways. I would just come back to the fact that I think when the Act was put in place in 2004, I understand fully how controversial it was. But if you look at most of the polling we see from people living in the countryside and town, over 70% of people, when they're regularly polled on this, say that they want to see the Hunting Act enforced properly. I do think that if you have more drag hunting, the use of bloodhounds rather than packs of foxhounds, I have concerns about the animal welfare of those hounds. Flora, you might disagree with me on that. But I would have no objections to seeing bloodhounds in the countryside that are not hunting wildlife. I have no objections to people riding against scents. You know, I think that works and I think it can be done. I think the problem has been that the hunting fraternity has wanted to hold on to something rather than actually move over to a new pastime that would have maintained a lot of the tradition of hunting, but without the cruelty, wildlife crime and public safety elements that we're seeing problems with, which is what the police are asking now to deal with more effectively, hence the need to tighten the legislation.
Dominic and Flora, I think we need to leave it there, but thank you both very much indeed for joining us. Thank you. And finally, is Sally Rooney still the voice of her generation? In the Lead Books review for the magazine this week, Claire Loudon reviews Sally Rooney's latest novel, Intermezzo, which she says is another case of compare and contrast. Is Sally Rooney's writing becoming one-dimensional, and where does she need to go from here? Claire joined me on the podcast to discuss, along with James Marriott, columnist for The Times. I started by asking Claire to give her impressions of the novel and how it stacks up to the rest of Sally Rooney's output.
Yeah, certainly. I think that the fourth novel, Intermezzo, this new one, falls for me into the same category as both Normal People, her second book, which I think is perhaps the standout success of the four, and then Beautiful World, Where Are You?, which is the slight oddball entry. But I think all these three novels, Normal People, Beautiful World, Where Are You?, and Intermezzo, have a big thing in common, which is that they're not very funny books. They are mostly quite serious, sincere books about people struggling in their 20s and now their early 30s to make their way in the world and with each other in often fraught relationships. And for me, what's really interesting is that the book she started with, the book that made her name, was Conversations with Friends, which for me is starting now to look like an outlier, because it's actually much drier, it's much funnier, it's much darker and more knowing, and almost reads like the work of somebody a bit older than the three books that followed it. So for me, Intermezzo is part of a growing trend in her work.
And James, what did you make of it? Because you've come on this podcast before, back in 2020, I believe, in which you said that you thought that Sally Rooney was the voice of a generation. But from your review in The Times, is it right to say that you're a little bit more lukewarm about the new book?
Yeah, I am. I should say that I think Sally Rooney is a better novelist than she's often given credit for. I do think the books that come after Conversations with Friends are funny. I think there's a sort of quiet irony that's often missed. And I think she's not always as completely politically serious as people take her to be. I think she's capable of slightly rolling her eyes at her character's political pretensions. I guess with the three previous novels, I'd kind of been giving her the benefit of the doubt. We know that those novels are kind of famously inhabit these quite narrow, quite intense, quite morally charged worlds. You know, in the last one especially, everyone's always saying things like, you know, we're living at the end of the world, you know, there's a looming climate crisis. The whole atmosphere of the book is sort of charged with this sense of living, the characters inhabiting this very sort of politically black and white world that's in a real state of crisis. And I sort of always thought that what these books were doing was very vividly presenting the way that we feel about the world when we're young adults and, you know, in adolescence. Things do seem very morally charged. The world does seem like quite a black and white place politically. And I guess the sort of disillusionment for me in this latest novel has come in the fact that that moral atmosphere is still in place, but no longer seems particularly appropriate to the lives of people in their 30s, for whom the world is a more complicated place, I think. And I don't know, I'm sort of, suddenly it all seems a bit narrow and a bit two-dimensional. And yeah, I really find myself very much in agreement with Claire's excellent review in The Spectator. She's really put her finger on, I think, the problem with the novel.
Mm. Well, something which you did put your finger on, Claire, which I very much enjoyed in your review, is you give a little guide on how to speak in Runish. I wonder if you could perhaps give a guide on this podcast to some of our listeners about how you speak in Runish.
Oh, well, you know what? I actually feel kind of mean doing this. She's not a novelist I want to attack, because, like James, I actually admire her. But it did become sort of, I think, unintentionally funny as I was reading it. I think she's trying to make the language strange so that we experience ordinary life afresh and more poetically and with the beauty that we often miss. But the way she's doing it is that she scrambles her syntax. So rather than saying the city feels empty, which is a kind of bland statement, she says, empty the city feels. Yeah, his eyes were sore and he felt hot would be a straight way of saying what comes out in Rooney speak as sore his eyes and hot he felt. And he really have to be kind of, I think, quite generous to her to go with this and not to start kind of giggling as you read. Saw his eyes and what he felt. It's just kind of a step too strange, I think.
And James, would you agree? Do you think there's something about that style which now is starting to become a little bit too familiar, perhaps?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not familiar because this is a departure in the new book. She, you know, her English sentences, the syntax happened in the correct order in the previous books. And the new book features, not for the whole book, but for parts of the book, this sort of strange sub-Joycean syntax that Claire describes. And I agree with her. I don't think it's there because it enhances our understanding of the world or says something new about the way that the character who is given this way of speaking perceives the world, Peter. I think it's there because Rooney hopes that we'll take it as a mark of the fact that she's a bit more serious and literary. And the fact that we recognise that Leopold Bloom in Ulysses is given, you know, a much more sophisticated version of this kind of, you know, speech with its odd syntax. She's hoping we'll hear that echo and think, ah, it's a bit like Ulysses, therefore it's very intelligent. And I sort of, you know, a novel should do things because, you know, it's a truthful and interesting way of presenting the world, not as a way of trying to, you know, trick readers into thinking it's cleverer than it is.
Well, Claire, you describe in your review, you say that it's that in this latest book there is a wider than usual gulf between the writer Rooney wants to be and the writer she actually is. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think this novel really sort of confirms something that I've wondered for a while. She's obviously an incredibly intelligent woman. She was on the international debating circuit, I believe, which you have to be. I mean, you just have to be very smart, very sharp, very quick. She's clearly read a huge amount in all sorts of different fields and has high intellectual standards for herself and the people around her. That's my kind of impression of her, even though I don't think we know that much about her. But that doesn't always translate into literary intelligence, weirdly. And I think that she is pushing hard for her novels to represent a certain level of kind of quite ritzy intellectual engagement that is belied by what she really wants to write about. I mean, it's funny to kind of talk about what somebody you don't know wants, kind of quite impertinent in a way. But my sense is that she wants to be a cleverer novelist than she really is. And I'd be fine for her not to be a very clever novelist. Like, she takes you along for a ride with a great story, good characters, lots of romance, lots of sex. They're kind of crowd-pleasing novels with an overlay of intellect that doesn't quite fit, if that makes sense.
So is that what you would like to see from her next, to just focus on those strengths?
Oh, I'd so hesitate to say what I'd like to see from her next, because I think it's all of our expectations and our scrutiny that probably caused Sally Rooney a great deal of trouble. She came on the scene very, very young and was never allowed to just get on and mature in her own way. What I would like to see from her next, okay, I'm going to dare it. I'd like to see her writing about a relationship that's been going for about 4 or 5 years and is hitting a bit of a boring patch, not about two characters falling in love and hopping on and off and sort of, what's it called, traumatic attachment. I don't know the exact term, but yeah, I'd like to see her write about an average relationship rather than a grand romantic beginning. Something a little bit, I suppose that tallies with what you were saying in your review, James, about feeling that she's still kind of writing young characters rather than characters in the 30s. But I think it might be difficult for her to draw on what I imagine is now her own life experience, because we're all watching her so closely that that kind of conversation between the events of your own life and the events on the page that people usually let novelists get on with might feel harder for her to access because of the mad scrutiny she's essentially grown up with. I feel quite sorry for her.
James, would you agree?
Yeah, I really do. And I made a similar point in my review, which is that all of these novels focus on characters who are incredibly beautiful, incredibly intelligent, often incredibly successful, intellectually, if not materially. And they're also incredibly good people. There are not really any Rooney characters who are seriously morally flawed. And I would love her to be able to write about characters who she doesn't agree with politically and morally. So there's a character in the new book called Darren, minor character, who's a corporate lawyer. And he's clearly viewed by the novel as this sort of total waste of space. You know, he's doing a job that doesn't contribute anything to civilization. He's really tasteless. And I would be interested to see whether Rooney thought she was capable of extending her artistic sympathy to a character who she didn't agree with and who had bad taste. And I sort of feel like that's a crucial test for anyone who aspires to write a literary or artistic novel rather than something that does risk being kind of just a romance novel.
Yeah, James, I completely agreed with that. I love that point you made. It made me think actually of a moment in the novel when two characters, Margaret, who's going out with Ivan, and their affair is quite illicit, really, because there's a big age gap and because she's actually until recently been married. And they're hanging out in her fairly rural area where everybody knows everybody else. And they want to go somewhere and have a meal together without being spotted on the way back from the beach. And Rooney has them drop into an old style country hotel where there are silver candlesticks and beautiful soft lighting and white linen on the tables. And, you know, fine, that's absolutely fine. She's free to send her characters wherever they want to eat. And these characters might have chosen to go there. But what might happen in a novel where the characters need to go somewhere in secret is they might have to drop into the nearest place at hand, and they might be a beef eater, and they might have to contend with LED tea lights and laminated menus, but that's never going to happen in a Rooney novel at the moment. And I'd quite like to see that bit of real, not so glamorous or tasteful life creeping in, and to see how she handles it. I think she'd do it very well.
And that's it for this week, but if you enjoyed the podcast, you can pick up a copy of the magazine to read everything we've discussed and more in full. And if you do enjoy the podcast and are listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Gus Carter.
And I'm William Moore, and we hope you'll join us again next week.